Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
There were definitely times that people, you know, would be like, oh, she's from Hollywood. And I was like, I didn't live in Hollywood. But that's what they thought. And yeah, there were definitely moments I felt discriminated against.
Good evening and welcome back to Midnight Chats. After quite some time off, we're back. I'm Stuart Stubbs and I'm here with Greg Cochran.
Hi, Stu. It is good to be back. It's been a minute.
This is it, isn't it? We're back for quite a while here. We've got like a lot of episodes coming up every Tuesday night at midnight. So if you're already a subscriber, you're locked in. If you're not, then please. I don't think they call it subscribing. It's called follow. That's how long we've been away. They've changed the way they talk about podcasts.
They have changed the way they talk about podcasts. But yeah, we're going to be here every week bringing you some of the biggest and best guests that we've ever had on Midnight Chat. So it's so exciting to be back. And we've been recording some brilliant conversations to bring like all of you listeners for the weeks and the months to come. And we're starting with a banger, Stu, a conversation that you had.
Yes, tonight's guest is Wiseblood. And this is one of the earliest ones I recorded for this new run. Recorded this back in November 2023. Natalie Mehring is Mehring. Natalie was in LA, where she was born and where she now lives. I was in London. This is a remote record. Some of these are going to be remote. Some are going to be face-to-face. This is a remote one. I mean, she's got such a good voice for this. This is like the perfect podcast voice. One of the reasons why we wanted to start this new run with Wiseblood. As I say, Natalie grew up in she was born in LA and then she moved to Pennsylvania. Then she bounced around to Portland. And people might not know this, but she got very heavily involved in noise music and experimental DIY music. Sounds kind of strange now, right? When you think of what Wiseblood Records sounds like, it sounds like sort of the Carpenters soundtracking the apocalypse. But back then she was making all sorts of strange music. So We talk about lots of things because her most recent album's already been out a year. So she wasn't in like for let's sell this new record. That record's called And In The Darkness Hearts Aglow. We talk a little bit about that, but we actually just talk more broadly about her life in music.
And growing up in the same town as Pink,
meeting Lou Reed at a rally in New York.
Yeah.
And Lou Reed's one of those people that tends to, his name pops up quite a lot on Midnight Chats, I find. Always has done.
Yeah.
All these, you know, 120 episodes before this one, he pops up every now and then. People like to talk about Lou Reed. And actually, this is one of the very rare times he's mentioned where he was nice to somebody.
Yeah, it was notoriously grumpy.
Bit of a grouch. So we hope you enjoyed this first episode back with Wiseblood. Give it a review. Another couple of new things that we've got as well as this new run. We've got some new social channels, which we've not had before. We're on Instagram and we're on TikTok, Midnight Chats Pod. Give us a follow on there. We're going to be posting some clips, some video clips from the interviews, some other bits and pieces, us larking about looking very handsome. So please find us over there. That's brand new. But for now, here is Wiseblood on tonight's episode of Midnight Chats. The first time I saw you was here in London. It was in 2015, and you were 100% solo at that point. I'm pretty sure it was just you and a guitar, an acoustic guitar, and you played at a place called the Lock Tavern, which is a small pub here in Camden. It was upstairs.
I remember that really clearly.
I'm guessing this would have been when you were touring The Innocents, right?
Oh, yeah.
If it was 2015.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would that have been your first sort of trip to the UK?
No, actually. So I toured in a band called Jackie O Motherfucker in 2007, which was like a weird kind of free experimental noise band from Portland, Oregon. And I would do like solo Wiseblood shows on certain shows. And then I kind of broke off of that tour and did like a weird solo tour. But yeah, that was, you know, so deep in the history of my musical trajectory. I was like 19 and playing very loud, crazy noise music. And then with Jackie O, it was kind of this very folky improv kind of grungy situation. It was a cool time in music where you could be a band like that and book a tour. And there was just such a community of people interested in experimental music. There's so much support that, yeah, I was, you know, taking trains and staying with promoters and friends. And it's very different than the kind of tours I did later.
Do you miss that way of doing it at all?
I mean, not like exactly, but I do really miss the community. There is something really nice about coming to a show and knowing people are going to come.
We've put on shows before for our magazine, and I have hated it. And I've hated that, yeah, that feeling of, is anyone going to show up tonight?
I mean, I will say that I did enjoy when nobody would come. Like, I mean, I think it's more just like, it makes financially more sense to tour knowing people are going to come. But like spiritually, there was something so special about the shows that people were very sparsely attended at. Like the shows that I saw as a kid of bands, you know, coming through Philly, that like, I think I saw that band Hella play to like 9 people. And the drummer, Zach, I wish I could remember his last name. He's the drummer of Death Grips.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He's amazing.
Yeah. And watching him play to 9 people in like the, you know, a church basement as a teenager just completely blew my mind. And I think if it was full of people, it would have been cool too. But there was something so unique about having such an intimate experience. And I was always into that. I always loved small shows and, yeah, playing for 5 people. I mean, maybe the worst thing is playing for no people. But luckily there was at least 1 person always.
You know, I know Jackie O Motherfucker and their music. I can completely hear their influence on what you're doing now. When you're saying like you'd play in that band, but then you'd do your solo shows as well. Was that under the name Wiseblood still?
Yeah, but it was spelled B-L-U-H-D.
Right. Was it really aggressive noise?
I think there were hints of, you know, the Wiseblood of the future, even in that, because there were songs. They were just very much like loud and kind of drony and blasting with electric guitar. I had this instrument that I built that was basically like a 6-foot long slide guitar. And I would play the harmonics on that and run my voice through it and have tapes going and loops and, you know, like, it was very modal, and I was very inspired by Nico and the Velvet Underground. So there were songs in there, but it was just kind of very loud. Those days were great. And I think I never did a wonderful job of documenting them. I was kind of too chicken to really put out records because people offered me, but it wasn't until I think 3 years later, I put out my first album after that.
Yeah. Would that have been the one on Not Not Fun?
Yeah.
I love that label. Is that label still going?
I don't think so. I think they're just kind of a legacy thing, but I could be wrong. I haven't touched base with them in a really long time. I did make one other album before that called Strange Chalices of Seeing that was just a CDR that I would sell at my shows.
so you're in LA now. You were born in LA, but you grew up in Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, I moved around a lot as a kid. I moved to Pennsylvania when I was 11, so I kind of spent the most of my formative years there.
And until then, you were in LA, so you have memories of LA as a kid, right?
Big time, yeah. I mean, I consider California my true home, and Pennsylvania is like, I always felt like an outsider on the East Coast. I always wanted to be from there, but it's such an old place that's so stubborn and stuck in its ways.
What was it that made you want to be from the East Coast?
Well, I think, yeah, because it just seemed cooler. It just seemed less, and I mean, now I've kind of grown to be more into the California thing, but California is so progressive that, you know, it has this weird nihilism to it. It's kind of lost, and all the culture is like completely fabricated, kind of smoke and mirrors culture, you know, kind of coinciding with also like the hippie movement, which is very inspirational to me. Like, I love, you know, all that stereotypical stuff, but the East Coast has a lot of Ivy League schools and people, you know, read books. So there's this, the kind of cool that comes out of the East Coast. I would compare it like the Velvet Underground versus the Grateful Dead, like both wonderful bands, but the Velvet Underground just has this kind of like reaching back into the 19th century kind of art trajectory, I guess.
Can you remember when you sort of realized what LA was to the rest of the world, you know, how it's looked upon, the film industry, the whole thing that is LA? Because obviously when you're born there, it's sort of, for a certain amount of time, I imagine, well, this is just home, it's all I know. But can you remember when you sort of, was it once you moved away, you realized how people felt about LA and how they sort of look upon it? Or was it whilst you were still there?
There were definitely times that people, you know, would be like, oh, she's from Hollywood. And I was like, I didn't live in Hollywood. But that's what they thought. And yeah, there were definitely moments I felt discriminated against just from like, I think one time, like a yard patrol person, like when you had recess, there's always like adults kind of patrolling the situation. And I talked back to her or something, and she said something like La La Land or something like that. But to this day, I don't know if I imagined it. Like, I wondered if I just created my own fantasy about it being so unique, but people were just like, whatever, I don't know. I mean, culturally, it was a culture shock, like going from LA to rural Pennsylvania, it's very different. But I remember also being so inspired by like history, like being confronted with, you know, history that's hundreds and hundreds of years old versus everything being relatively kind of new.
Now, considering what you do, and do you have any dealings with Hollywood? Do you ever sort of dip your toe in that world?
I mean, just as much as any other musician, I guess. Maybe a little more because I like love movies. But I don't know. I mean, you can, if you want that, you can definitely roll up in LA and you can go to parties and you can see celebs if you want. It's a bit of a spectacle. I don't necessarily like seek that out, but I'm sure it's something that could be intoxicating to somebody who's never experienced it.
Yeah, I find it very intoxicating. Have you been?
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's, you know, that's the trade. We've got the really old buildings, and then you've got the movie system and the stars, and it's very...
I will tell one funny story. I actually have a roommate, and he's way more connected with the film industry because he dated an actress for a long time. And so we were watching the Golden Globes just for fun. And then afterward, he was like, well, that was pretty cool. Do you want to go see all those people? And I was just kind of like, I'm in my pajamas. I don't know. And he's just like, throw on a dress. And so I just put on a dress and we rolled to this party and saw like everybody. It was like the Golden Globes, like after party or whatever. And
yes,
saw everybody. And I remember thinking like, you know, just a second ago, I was like going to go to sleep. And here I am like standing and Leo just walked by or whatever. And it was definitely fascinating. I bet.
Yeah. This is the allure of LA to me.
Yeah. And I do think it's like, it is important at least to mention that like the whole kind of institution of fame and celebrity is really, you know, kind of depressing. So I think, you know, living in LA, being from here and having, you know, different qualities that I associate with it, sometimes I do think that like, that kind of attitude towards it makes it way less interesting.
Yeah.
You know, like as a community, I think that it's already really difficult because it's a huge sprawl of a city that's everything's just so spread out. It's like these little tiny villages. And so like to have a social atmosphere kind of based on people, you know, trying to be in the right place at the right moment and not really kind of being, you know, present, it makes for like, yeah, pretty dramatic variation in like social engagement.
Mm.
When I think other cities have maybe a little bit more of a genuine, you know, physical situation like New York, where you kind of have to be around everybody all the time.
Yes.
In LA, you kind of drive around in your pod and you pick and choose, and yeah, it can get really psychedelic. And I think that I find it sad when people and artists and musicians move here and kind of just, you know, want to sleep with a movie star and that's like why they're here. I think LA has changed, you know. I think people move here now to do music and be cool.
And do you think it's better for it? Do you think that's a good thing?
No. I think that a part of maybe what was so cool about LA in the past was that it really did have a very distinct quality to it because it wasn't your typical city. And then I think when a lot of people moved here, some of those qualities, you know, kind of got a little blurred with just basic gentrification. But I do think that that is the perspective any person would have, you know, like, oh, 10 or 15 years ago, it was really great. You know, it's like, that is definitely, you know, just kind of me revealing my age at that point.
What was Doylestown like? Because that's where those formative years we were talking about in Pennsylvania, they were in Doylestown, right?
Yeah, Doto.
Doto, is that what it's called?
That's what we would call it sometimes.
Okay, nice.
Doylestown is like a very cute, small town near a lot of farms. There's actually like a borough with like a little clock tower and an old tile factory from the 19th century that's all made of cement. And yeah, I mean, it was definitely like, you know, not much going on. There was a cool community of, you know, hardcore bands.
I read that Pink is from Doylestown.
Oh, yeah.
The artist Pink.
Totally.
So
is Justin Guarini.
Who's Justin Guarini? I don't know.
He was the first American Idol. It was him and Kelly Clarkson against each other.
Oh, and did Kelly win that? Or did?
Oh, yeah, she won. Yeah.
Pink's are quite a bit older than you, maybe 10 years older than you, I think. So it's not like you probably wouldn't have come into like contact with her at school and stuff.
I met her once in middle school.
Oh, you did?
She came and visited my choir teacher that was her choir teacher.
Was this once she had already become a star?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just remember I went up to her and I was like, do you like The Kids in the Hall? Because I was like obsessed with that TV show, The Kids in the Hall. And she's like, I like that show. That's all we said to each other. But...
That's a nice... And you haven't met her since?
No.
But when you do meet her, you're going to have... lots to talk about.
We'll talk about Doylestown. I know she, so I live off a road called Pebble Hill Road. And I remember she had some connection to that road. She would like practice with some grungy band.
So at what point did you move to Portland?
For college. I went to college for 1 year in Portland.
You got into the noise scene there, but were you already sort of interested?
No, I got into noise in high school. I think it was when I started going to shows in the city. I'd take the train to Philly and just try to go to as many shows as I could. And I mean, the hardcore noise kind of overlap was just kind of starting to happen. And I saw this band Buzzard Stain, which was, yeah, Nate from Wolf Eyes and Twig from Nautical Almanac. And that was like, I guess, the first proper noise band that I saw live. And I just remember immediately being like, this is the future. Like, this is it. These guys have cracked the code. This is completely new. It completely deconstructs rock and roll. Like this is the logical progression of music. So I really drank the Kool-Aid and then I, you know, got the Wolf Eyes Sub Pop record and started just going to record stores and combing the new arrival section and looking for weird kind of noisy music. And then, you know, because the internet was starting to happen, getting on MySpace and kind of posting my weird kind of noisy music to MySpace, I met a lot of people. It's really funny when I later on when I lived in Baltimore, I met Alex from Beach House. And we were just chatting and he's like, you know what's really funny? Maybe like in 2006, I saw your MySpace page and I thought it was really weird and cool. And I never forgot that. And I was just like, yeah, like that was a cool time, you know. You could book a whole tour on MySpace. It was really funny.
It was great, wasn't it? It was like sort of the I guess it was this little window when social media was sort of felt quite pure and very community led. People hadn't started just using it to sort of, it hadn't been weaponized as much, I guess, or it hadn't been co-opted. And
no.
I think because it was so music focused that, you know, you just discovered so much stuff and it was just, it had just had a real DIY quality to it, didn't it? That I think
it did, yeah.
Evaporated
and
quite quickly.
I think that's because that kind of golden age we're talking about was when people were taking what they knew from real life and just applying it to the medium.
Mm, yes.
Versus the medium informing real life, which I think like at a certain point, the scales tipped.
Sure.
But like, yeah, you'd go on MySpace and you'd connect with people, but you would connect with them because you wanted to find out where to go. You know, it wasn't like this disembodied internet only presence.
Yeah. And people weren't really lurking on there. It felt like everybody was active. If you were on it, you were contributing something to it.
Yeah. I lurked a little bit too.
Okay. Yeah.
I've always been a lurker, FYI, but.
How are you with social media now?
Yeah, I mean, I try not to get too into it. I'm like everybody else where like the algorithm has figured out the reels that I want to see. And I mean, I'm kind of just as complicit as most people, which is funny because I do preach the negative effects of having your life constantly kind of interrupted by this dopamine machine. But I think for me, touring and kind of engaging with my fans kind of eclipsed my desire to be, you know, totally private. And doing an album cycle and doing social media at the same time was really fun. Just to let them know what's going on. Because I think nowadays we don't have necessarily the same kind of music journalism we used to. And getting people to know about what's happening is difficult. And especially with the algorithm too, like who knows if your fans or your followers are even going to see your posts. So I think it is important to stay engaged with your fans. So I kind of look at it like it's really between me and them and everything else is just kind of whatever. And I can't pretend to be anything that I'm not. So I kind of gave up on that a long time ago. I would say though, like last thought about social media is I do think the industry of music kind of, I think people who do 9-to-5s at a label or like, you know, A&R people, I don't think they really know why people love music. And I think they think, oh, you just need to get viral or you just need to be like out there, like, look at these numbers, you know, like that's all true. But I think there's like a deeper mystery to what makes music good. And the people that actually just record really good music and make good songs don't have to be on social media. As you see, like sometimes the biggest people eventually just say, like, see ya, like no need. So I do think that that's a myth that needs to be broken, is this idea that like, oh, I'm a musician and it's so hard because I have to keep posting. And it's like, sadly, maybe you should listen to your music and you know, like kind of take it from there. Versus, you know, like work on catching up with all the TikTok trends. Like, I think if people focused more on, you know, writing great music, it would create a better environment versus like learning how to be digitally savvy or something. I don't know.
Do you think that's true of new artists as well, though? Because someone like Sia, for example, you know, she definitely doesn't need to be on there, but she's sort of already got that fan base that's going to find the stuff. I think if you're sort of operating in an underground DIY scene, then maybe you're still sort of attracting an audience, a core audience, in quite an effective way without it. And then there seems to me to be this big gap between that sort of crowd of artists and, you know, established artists who without it would sort of be a bit stuck with how do they, you know, share release dates, all of that sort of thing. And I think they therefore are forced into falling into this world where the social media becomes almost as important as the thing they're making.
Well, yeah, no, of course. I think what I mean more is actually like you do when there's no way for anybody to know anything about you. It is important to have like a centralized place that exists in the hyperspace of the internet for people to find out. Whether or not that's your voice or whether or not you're posting selfies or posting what you ate that day. I mean, that's kind of more what I'm talking about is like, you can be like a, you know, you can have information about you on the internet. And unfortunately, without the same kind of DIY scene that I used to have in terms of just like being on a tour circuit, a lot of those venues shut down. So it is harder to kind of tour and build this grassroots IRL presence. But I still think that, you know, the music is what gets you to the place.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Talking of venues that shut down, is the smell still there in LA or is that gone?
The smell is still here.
Oh, it is still there. Okay, nice. Because I remember...
I think it's an institution.
I was got so into the first Health album.
Oh, yeah.
Which they recorded in this, inside the smell. I think they spent days just hitting snares in there and miking it all up. And around that time, I became really sort of just fascinated by that whole scene and that venue. And it was, you know, had a bit of sort of presence in UK sort of underground media, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard it written about for a while. So I was wondering if it was still there or if it had been sort of, you know, closed for whatever reason. But it's good to hear that's still there.
Yeah. I mean, I also think there was my friend had a DIY space for a while and he shut it down because people just wouldn't show up. And my other friend in Nashville made a joke t-shirt called, "Yeah, I love DIY." And then across DIY was spelled "Doubt, I'll go to your show." So, I mean, I do think there's a couple reasons why the DIY scene dried up. I do think in some ways people became less interesting performers. And I think... Right. That people also started being there, looking at their phones, not thinking it was the center of the universe, like being like, oh, there might be another place to be, or like, this might not be the place. And that lack of, you know, kind of focus, because when I was young, it's like any show you'd go to, you'd show up and it just felt like the center of the universe. It felt like there was no other place you could possibly want to be or be, like that was the place. And I don't know if people still get that feeling as much at these little shows. I'm sure they do. I think it's kind of always going to be subsisting in the underground of with like young people always. But I do think that there was like a noticeable dip in attendance at shows like that at a certain point. And I do think a part of it is the phones.
Do phones generally bother you when you're on stage?
I mean, I notice when people are filming me and I'm like, oh, I hope it sounds good.
But it doesn't bother you that they're doing that rather than just listening?
No, I mean, I'm not going to Bob Dylan it. I'm not going to be like, put your phone down. To each his own, you know?
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
One thing I really wanted to ask you about was the front cover, the album art of Titanic Rising, because it's such an amazing photo. And I wanted to ask you how you created it. And is it essentially as simple as it looks? I'm sure everyone does know what this image I'm talking about looks like, but in case they don't, it is an underwater, a bedroom that is completely submerged underwater. And you're at the bottom of the tank, I guess, if you shot it in a tank, as if you're standing in the room that has got a desk in it and a bed and a laptop, I think, and stuff's on the table. And it's so beautifully shot, but it's sort of, I'll put a link under this podcast so people can view it easily. But how did that image come about, and how did you do it?
I did it in a swimming pool. I found a photographer who liked to shoot things underwater, who knew about what it was like to work underwater, because everything is twice as hard. It takes twice as much time. Twice as many things can go wrong.
I bet.
You can't breathe, you know. So the root of the idea started with, I was talking to my roommate at the time, who's a painter, Ariana Papa de Metropolis. She's a really brilliant painter. And I was like, I really want to do an underwater album cover. And I want it to be like a living room, and I'm like sitting on the couch. And then she kind of was like, maybe you should do a bedroom. And then I was like, oh my gosh, that's an incredible idea. So then I kind of gathered all the stuff for the bedroom. Like, I found things in the trash, I thrifted, I did all the creative direction, you know, with that, with my manager at the time. And we actually hired somebody to build the set underwater, but he failed because he didn't realize how difficult it would be. So the second time around, we were successful in making the walls and kind of stapling everything down so it didn't completely float away. And then we had, you know, a good 3 hours to shoot before everything started to disintegrate and bloat and really change. So it was like this very time and space capturing moment.
I've got it in front of me here. There's a little dressing table on the right, but there's a sort of chest of drawers, I guess, at the back there where your hi-fi on it, which I can see is sort of bowing. Was that because of the water, or was it Okay, right. So when you put it in there, it wasn't doing that.
I mean, it's all like kind of particle wood furniture, so yeah.
You also look, because you're in it as well, and you look so sort of, you look very relaxed, and you're not, it doesn't look like you're being weighed down. Did you just
gotta exhale.
Okay, like a free diver.
Yeah, no, there was like a major learning curve with like getting over the feeling of being in there and being like, you're gonna die because you're holding your breath. And kind of the mind over matter of like getting down and like sinking into the room and just spending, you know, like kind of like 10 seconds at a time relaxed, and then kind of going back up for air. And it was really, really difficult because the chlorine in the water was really intense. So by the end of the night, I actually couldn't see anything. I was like blinded by how many hours I'd spent with my eyes open underwater. Yeah, it was, you know, the sacrifices we make for art. It's really beautiful. It's all worth it.
We appreciate it. As fans, we appreciate it. Yeah, absolutely. It's worth it. Yeah. It's been a year, almost to the day, since And the Darkness Hearts Aglow. Do you genuinely like looking back on things, or are you more head forward, looking for the next thing?
I'm looking for the next thing, usually.
Yeah.
Especially with recorded music, because you spend so much time making it and recording it and mixing it that by the end of it, you're kind of like, I just want to make another thing now to erase that memory. And then also playing it for a year, you know, is really fun and rewarding, but also like, yeah, you want to play new songs after a while.
Is the plan still for the next record to be the final part of the trilogy that you're currently working on, with Titanic Rising being the first part, current album being the second, and you've got one more.
Yeah.
And which is going to be, from what I've heard and read in interviews from yourself, hopeful. We're into the hope stage. So, is that still the plan?
Yeah, I've been writing and I haven't really gone into the studio yet, but I've been writing a lot.
How's 2023 been for you generally?
Life-changing. I think this year, I mean, I love 23 anyway, so I kind of had good feelings about the year anyway, but it was alchemical. You know, I think like everybody else, my experience of the pandemic really shifted my relationship with the world and myself, and it was a pretty jarring experience for me. So getting to come back out and sing these songs and share it with an audience was really healing and kind of like reaching this point of just running on pure spirit, because it was also really exhausting because the pandemic was such an exhausting experience. Like there would be these kind of expansions and then contraction where it's like summer 2021, we're back and everybody's raging. And then all of a sudden, like, no, we're not back. It's, you know, like I think there was a little stop and go. And so like everybody kind of had their own reactions at different times because it dragged on.
21 was my worst. And then 22.
2021, what was that? Oh,
that brutal. That was as low as it could get, I think, for me.
But the parties in that summer were some of the most fun parties I've ever been to. So.
Did you have a good time at Glastonbury this year?
Oh, yeah, I loved it. It was one of the best.
Was that your first time or you'd been before?
That was my first time. I also, like, I had, like, a midlife club crisis. What is it? Is it called Sector 9? What is the section of the festival that's all the clubs?
It's Block 9?
Block 9, yeah. Yeah, no, I had a really good time at Block 9. And I just found like the whole vibe of the festival was so magical. And it's so, you know, funny that like we in America had Woodstock, but we just could not keep that energy going. And it's amazing that in the UK, you guys have kept that energy going since the early 70s with one festival. It's pretty miraculous.
It's just amazing how, yeah, that they've sustained it and it hasn't got sort of fucked up in any way. Like we, you know, they still don't really have a big sponsor. The money goes to, you know, their partner is Greenpeace. And it's this one weekend where everyone can sort of just experience sort of how good things could be perhaps for a finite time. I mean, I don't think I would want to live in Glastonbury forever, but whilst it's on, I mean, it's quite unbearable. I'm glad you enjoyed it. You played a lovely stage as well. That park stage on the hill is really a nice spot.
It was really special.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
You're obviously a huge fan of the Velvet Underground. And I just wanted to ask you what it was like to feature on John Cale's album, Mercy, this year.
It was a huge, huge deal for me. It was a really big moment. We actually recorded that many years ago. How I met John was I interviewed him for a magazine, and my questions were just so specific and deep cut that I think he was a little intrigued about who I was. And he checked out my music and then invited me to come sing. And when I sang, it was like he was, you know, kind of getting me to sing these really low notes, which he ended up kind of altering in post. And like the song became unrecognizable to what we had recorded, which I thought was really, really creative and cool. And his studio was just kind of full of toy pianos and nothing else, which I thought was really wild. And apparently at the end of the recording, he smashed them all. But yeah, just meeting him, it was so wonderful to get to kind of talk about classical music and just all these things that I never get to talk to other musicians about. It's rare to meet somebody who there's so many meeting points of, kind of taste and kind of respect that I have for him. And every moment I get with him, I think is so precious.
Yeah. I mean, for someone who loves that band, and that band obviously means so much to you, it's sort of, it doesn't much get much better than that, does it? Especially if the experience is a really positive one and you've not gone and met John Cale and it's been horrible.
Yeah, no, I feel really lucky. I got to meet Lou Reed too, and he was really nice to me, which is really rare. I feel like that was like a weird like gift from the heavens or something. I was at Occupy Wall Street leaving with a big protest sign. And Lou Reed literally came up to me and he was like, "How's the protest?" And then he took my hand and he started warming my hand because it was really cold and looking into my eyes. And I was like, "What is going on? Like, this guy's being so nice." And then I ran to my car. I got a copy of The Outside Room, my first, you know, album, and handed it to him. And then I think he was a little like, "Oh, you do music? Weird."
So he just approached you, and it wasn't because you were an artist and he wanted to talk to you about that. He was just being a friendly guy.
He just saw, I was dressed pretty funny. I was like dressed in a weird medieval outfit, and I had like a, you know, a sign about not letting the capitalist zombies take over.
Did he join in the protest, or was he passing by?
Yeah, he was around for Occupy for sure. Definitely.
Amazing guy to me. Did you ever see him play?
No, I was just so young that I kind of missed. I think at that age, I wouldn't spend money on concert tickets, something I sorely regret now, but I always thought they were too expensive.
I saw him once towards the end, and it was kind of like, I mean, he certainly wasn't nice to the people on stage like he was to you. He was furious at his band. He must have liked you. I don't know what his band had done, but that.
I mean, I hear these stories all the time. It's scary. It's sad.
Yeah, he was pretty livid. He spent the whole time just ragging on the whole band for everything they did, and he played some really strange versions of Velvet's tunes, which, you know, still great. You're getting to hear Lou Reed play some Velvet Underground, but he would just be quite contrary and play them all at like half speed or just strange Lou Reedness. But
you know, Bob Dylan does a very similar thing. It's really weird.
Yeah, have you seen him?
I saw him play maybe 8 years ago. I don't know, his recent show is probably different, but the show that I saw, he would do, you know, like, "The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind." Like, he would just change all the timing. And the audience would be singing the old timing. So there was weird cacophonous, like, kind of murky, like, you know, version of the song kind of roaring throughout the stadium. And he was just like free, you know, freestyling over it. It was pretty psychedelic.
I don't understand why he does that.
I think they have to. I don't think they can keep doing the same thing for like 40, 50, 60 years. Like, yeah, that guy at this point, 60 years, could you sing the same song for 60 years?
That's true. But do you think, like, just don't play it? Like, it's fine to not play it, isn't it? Because I think people get more upset hearing it offbeat or strange than just not doing it.
Yeah, but I don't know. I get it. It's a weird decision, but I understand it. It's a meeting point. It's a compromise. Let's give the people what they want, but only a little bit.
Midnight Chats is a joint production between Loud and Quiet and Atomized Studios for iHeartRadio.
It's hosted by Stuart Stubbs and Greg Cochran, mixed and mastered by Flo Lines, and edited by Stuart Stubbs.
Find us on Instagram and TikTok to watch clips from our recordings and much, much more. We are Midnight Chats Pod.
For more information, visit loudandquiet.com.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.